Hello everyone, this is Sam Fragoso, the founder and editor-in-chief of Movie Mezzanine, and this morning I'm fortunate enough to talk with the new senior editor of Film.com, the co-host of the movie podcast Operation Kino, and the founder of the infamous Criterion Corner, David Ehrlich. Thanks for being here this morning.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It's great having you, and thank you for kind of allowing me to continue this series of interviews where I speak with some of the best film critics around, so...
Oh. I'm in, you know, quite esteemed company. So
it sounds like you immediately disagree with that premise.
No. I disagree with the premise. You know, once you involve me in it, still that sounded right.
So something I didn't mention before this. Admittedly, I didn't really start reading your writing until about a month and a half ago. I think it was from Corey Attad, who was kind of telling me that you were very good and that I should seek you out. And then I went to Sundance in January. And any time you were brought up in conversation, which was surprisingly a decent amount, just about everyone, Matt Patches, Katie Rich, Jordan Raup, and Eric DeSnyder, just about everyone said you were so a great writer, insightful, and humorous. So I think that's kind of when I started to look into you, and obviously they were correct. Obviously, clearly. Irrefutably so.
I feel like I'm so I'm such a bully to Corey on Twitter because I disagree with such a huge percentage of the things that he says. But
well, it's okay.
He's a very nice guy.
No, he is very nice. It's okay because most of the things he says are bullshit. You haven't met him, have you?
I haven't, no.
Oh, okay. No, he's actually a great guy.
I figured as much, yeah.
Okay, so kind of to get to the point, as someone who doesn't know that much about you, what are five films that you love? I mean, I do know that you have a devotion to Lost in Translation, so if you want to say that movie five times... I won't be wrong for it.
Yeah, no, I do have this weird affinity for Lost in Translation. I'm a big vowed fan of all of Sofia Coppola's films, but there's something about that one in particular, perhaps owing to sort of where I was in my life when it first came out. I had a unique theatrical relationship with it. I'm not the kind of person that often sees the same film more than once in the theater.
And you saw it 10 times.
And I saw that, at least 6 or 7 times. And they're just sort of tagging along with friends whenever they were going to it. And I think it sort of dovetailed with the burgeoning fascination with Japan, which had sort of been at the genesis of my love for movies. It started, kind of cliched with a love for Kurosawa and whatnot. I ended up writing my college admissions essay about trying to find his grave, ended up sort of spending a lot of time in Japan, and there's just something about Lost in Translation that really did it for me. And I think there are other films of that ilk that sort of have a relationship with Japan that also speak to me. I think of Chris Marker's Sans Soleil, which is probably one of my five favorite films, and other foreigners going over there and making films. I think of Paul Schrader's Mishima, Life in Four Chapters, which I think is perhaps the greatest film ever made about a real world figure. And what's the other films that I love? I mean, Close Up by Kiarostami is probably, I think I'm sort of bullshitting whenever anyone asks me what my favorite movie is, and I have a stock response. But I think on most days, that's my immediate answer is Close Up. I saw that in film school when I was an undergrad on some godforsaken hour one Tuesday morning or whatever it was. And I will never forget the experience of watching it and then participating in sort of a discussion group with my classmates immediately afterwards, most of whom weren't film majors. They were just people from around the university who were happening to take that class and were bored stiff. And I was just like, I had never seen myself so passionate. I mean, I'm the kind of person that doesn't necessarily choose himself sort of how excited I want to be about something at any given moment. And so I was sort of detached from my own reaction to it and sort of surprised by how passionate I was about this film and sort of getting really
I could totally see you just like getting up and just yelling at everyone for not liking this movie that you just adored.
Yeah, I connected to it so powerfully, and my love for Kiarostami has really stuck with me ever since then, up to including his new film, Like Someone in Love, which came out yesterday. And let's see, that's four. I probably have a list somewhere around here, but I don't know. I should pull up a fifth. Bear with me. Let's see.
That's okay. It's funny while you do that.
I'm done. I'll stick with Japan. Stick with the Japan theme. I'll go with Hirokazu Koreeda's Afterlife, which I think is probably my second favorite film of the 90s after Close Up. It's a film about people in death's waiting room, literally, in sort of waiting to get into heaven after they've died, and being interviewed about trying to find one memory from their lives that in the third act of the film they then film and recreate to take with them to the afterlife. And I think that you can, if you were to take the time, and I wouldn't necessarily recommend you to, at least with me in mind, to sort of explore the connections between a film like that and a film like Mishima and Close Up, you'll see that it's really easy to predict, for the most part, the kind of movies that I respond to.
It's funny that you mentioned Close Up, because when I spoke to Matt Singer of IndieWire and the CriticWire blog, that was one of the films he mentioned, and at the time I was like, oh, God, I really need to see that movie, and I still, right now, really need to see that movie.
Yeah, I think every human should really.
Human, yeah. For me, it doesn't seem like the type of movie I'm going to be like, Mom, we're going to watch Close Up this afternoon. Enjoy.
Yeah, it may not be, I don't know anything about your mom, and I think I've read, like...
Well, I wouldn't expect you to.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's probably for the best, but I think I've seen her pop up in some of your tweets, and I've made note of the fact that she seems maybe a little bit more engaged in the film world than my mom might be, but at the same time, I think Close Up might be one of those, personal watch-it-by-yourself experience.
No, I understand. No, my parents are, they're... I think film literate, at least in American cinema, which, I mean, even now, I mean, I'm really kind of behind on all that. I still have a lot to learn, but it's interesting because every time I speak to someone, to a film critic, they have kind of their own story as to how they got into the realm of film criticism, because it is such, I think if you take a step back, it is such a strange field. I mean, we're writing about movies, which seems kind of basic, but it is kind of a weird profession to go into. So if you have a story or just...
I think my story, if anything, sort of confirms what you were just saying, and that especially in this day and age where everyone... You're sort of doing professionally, or I say that with sort of air quotes, at an ostensibly professional level, what now anyone is empowered to do, of course. And so I think that how you sort of make that transition from doing it as a hobby into having it take on a different arena in your life can be strange. And for me, it was, I'd gone to film school. I'd worked at Apple as a personal shopper, which is now no longer a position that exists. Because I guess they realized during my tenure there that they're like, oh no, fuck it, we have to shut this whole program down. And
what do you do as a personal shopper?
This is a long story that I won't go into, but it's essentially like any specialist that you'll see at an Apple store, but
the
you
geniuses?
Can make a point. No, like the specialists are like the people who help you buy things. And they, you could make appointments, free appointments in advance. That someone would sort of be waiting for you when you came in the store and would walk you and spend as much time with you as you wanted. And I sort of realized at the time that it was antithetical to Apple's whole strategy, which is that everyone should be feeling that they're having that experience. But they were willing to pay me more money to do the same job that my friends are doing. And so I was like, fine. But I decided that I wanted, I'd always known I wanted to be a filmmaker. And I was just killing time there. And I decided I wanted to go to film school for an MFA to get behind the camera. And so I went to Japan, and I made a movie there, and I made a movie when I came back, and I applied to film school, and that whole thing. And somewhere along the way, my friend, who I'd gone to Comic-Con with for a million years, Comic-Con not being my, I'd say that world is not really my area of most interest within film, but I love the people that I went with, and so it's sort of been an annual tradition, had said that she knew of a website called Cinematical that was looking for someone to cover Comic-Con for them. And I should say that I was the film editor for the Columbia University newspaper when I was there, so it's not as if I was entirely foreign to this world.
Yeah.
But I was like, yeah, sure. I mean, I'll talk to the guy. And I talked to a guy named Eric Davis, who is one of the great people that I've met in this field.
Movies.com.
Right, movies.com. I mean, I love that guy, and he did everything for me. And so I'd recommend that everyone check out his site and him personally. But he brought me on. He took a chance and just said, all right, fuck it. Go to Comic-Con, write some stuff. And I did, and I just sort of started writing regularly for them and created that Criterion Corner column and went with him and crossed a few different sites and started writing reviews for Box Office Magazine, which now no longer runs reviews. Sort of it went from there.
I mean, that's Eric Davis. I also met him at Sundance, and he's an incredibly nice guy. But yeah, I mean, it's funny how people get into film criticism and kind of, like, quote-unquote, like, what their break was, in a way.
Yeah.
Because everyone has a different story, and some people are still waiting for that break. And but did you have one of those moments of, like, realization when you knew you wanted to write about movies? Like, was there a film that opened your eyes, in a sense?
Yeah, I mean, you know, to go back to close-up, I always knew that I enjoyed writing about film because when I was a film studies major at school in a program that was all theory and no, you know, that you had no interaction with a camera, it was all about, you know, writing about movies and watching movies. I took as much pleasure as one can, I would imagine, in writing long academic essays at 4 a.m, cracked out on, you know, questionable substances, and so I knew that, like, there was a certain pleasure for me in really disappearing up my own asshole and talking about movies and film history and theory and whatnot. And so the idea of getting paid for that or sharing it with an audience beyond just my professor was great. I mean, I slaved away in college over writing a 50-page paper on Aguirre, The Wrath of God, the Herzog film. I remember being, you know, I wasn't necessarily incredibly proud of the document, like I created some great work or anything, but at the same time, to spend all that time writing it and knowing that only one person was going to be reading it was kind of disappointing. And so I think that may have sort of cemented the seed that that if I were to do that, which I enjoyed, that I'd want to find a way to do it in a way that, you know, people could actually read it. And so it led me quite naturally to film criticism.
How was writing that?
It was fun. I mean, again, I wouldn't recommend it for everyone, but I really enjoyed it, especially because, you know, so much of what you do in an academic environment involves sort of just condensing other previously written things by greater minds than yours and just, you know, regurgitating it in a readable form. And at that time, there hadn't been any formal books of criticism written about Herzog's films. There was really just Herzog on Herzog, which is an incredible document in and of itself. But, and so it was fun to, you know, again, I don't think I was pioneering any sort of particularly fascinating novel forms of thought on this guy, but it was fun to it feels as if I was sort of exploring new terrain and still feeling certain that there was a certain legitimacy to what I was saying about him, that I was actually contributing in some micro some incredibly small way to I don't know, a different field of thought on this guy. So it was fun.
I don't know much about Herzog. I think he is the only filmmaker to make a film in every continent.
That's a neat bit of trivia that, you know, when you say that, I think, I know, oh, yeah, of course. But I did not know that beforehand.
Let's kind of remember this moment as the only time where I know something that you don't.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's why he made that movie about Antarctica, was just so we could have that claim. He's so infatuated with perpetuating his own myth that I would not be surprised in the slightest if that thought occurred to him and then inspired the direction of his career.
So you're talking about filmmaking. Is that something you want to pursue?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in school for it right now and doling out, you know, all the money I have in the world and then some, which is not something that I'm particularly thrilled about often, yeah. Especially because I'm not entirely sold yet on the value of film school for me. But yeah, I mean, I've always wanted to be a filmmaker, and I think the brief history of film shows that it's certainly possible for, you know, film critics to do both. And I think, you know, I was reading an interview with Tarantino recently where he was saying that he had envisioned a future for himself now in going back to film criticism. So often you see it the other way, where you have, like, you know, the Godards of the world who are starting writing for Cahiers du Cinéma and then go and make movies. But, you know, maybe it's a two-way street. But, at this particular point in time for me, it's been incredibly stressful juggling both and hoping not to... it's to not waste my creative energy in a way that all of my energy is being spent on one domain, on, like, you know, maintaining a website, mm-hmm. and my creative endeavors as far as filmmaking are suffering. And so it's been really difficult to juggle both, but I'd really like to leave both doors open right now.
Oh, that's great. I mean, I'm especially glad that you can effectively compare yourself to Godard.
at his level necessarily, but it's like me getting in a car in my Jetta from high school and driving to school and comparing myself to Mario Andretti, who also gets in a car and drives. I'd say that's really about the extent of it.
Was it Godard that this is just another bullshit trivia that I'm pretty sure didn't he get banned from the Cannes Film Festival, or maybe that was Truffaut. No, I think it was Godard.
He may have. I remember reading about that back in. He had a rather inflammatory period, even for him. In the
I was to say he's still inflammatory.
And now you have people that I think sort of fetishize the pleasure of being banned from the Cannes Film Festival, like Lars von Trier.
Oh, that was kind of ridiculous. So someone who's attending grad school at Columbia, I'm kind of always impressed by your ability to, especially in your writing, to blend, like, insight, academia, and, like, humor into your writing. And I know a lot of writers in film school right now who are, used to turning in 20, 30, 40-page papers on something like the importance of, like, Federico Fellini and surrealism. That is a completely made-up topic. That could be a paper in your class. I don't
sure.
know. Maybe. I'm not in film school, so I have no fucking clue. So when these students attempt to write something outside of the realm of academia, I kind of notice that they struggle with it not sounding like a college essay. And so everything kind of sounds academic. Not that I don't like academic. Those are sometimes my favorite things to read about. But how do you kind of... I don't know if this is making sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. I mean, there's you got to wear a lot of hats. You know, there's a time and a place for every kind of tone. And I think as, you know... I went immediately from writing in academia to writing news stories about Comic-Con. And so you have to understand what your audience is and... what they're looking for. And, you can't really afford to put on airs or be like, oh, I'm above this. You just have to make everything as engaging as you can. And I think that there are a lot of skills in writing that I don't have and that I'll never possess that I really envy about other people's writing. But the one thing that does come naturally to me is a certain dexterity in figuring out what they want. And I think sometimes I do it better than others. I mean, there are a lot of times where I try to force maybe an academic approach to these, like, 3,000 word articles that I was writing for Movie Phone. And I was getting a lot of flack for that from my editors, who were super nice about it. But at the same time, they're like, dude, you're killing us. I think it's a really good weapon for any writer to have just to be able to mix it up. And you get a neat little alchemy when you mix those tacks. I mean, it's like, you know, when you write a fluff article coming from sort of a more academic voice or vice versa, I think it can have some really interesting results, and it allows you to sort of poke and prod people in a way. I think of like the most overrated movies of the year articles that was writing for the end of the year at movies.com. And, you know, you go in, and I think that if you have a certain confidence in the kind of voice that you're using for anything, it allows you a certain freedom in how you want to approach something. So you can, with a certain amount of confidence, write an article like that and try to bury insights under a guise of just trying to anger people.
You definitely did that with me. I remember reading that. I think Silver Linings Playbook was on that.
Yeah.
Probably, or just Argo, just Eddie.
Both, I think.
Probably, yeah, and I didn't enjoy that very much.
But I think that, you know, again, in a piece like that, you're going to be much more effective at riling people up if you write with a basis of truth and with an insight that I think you're going to bother them more if they see your point, you know, rather than just simply making derogatory remarks about the movies they love and the people who love them. So I think I like to think that you can find a way to sort of really anger them by having valid points to make.
Yeah, admittedly, I don't think that article was as upsetting as something like Armin White's, like, better than list of the year, which I just find so fucking... Like, I like Armin White to the degree that I'm interested in what he has to say, even though I think it's kind of ridiculous most of the time. I rarely agree with it, but that sort of... Yeah, I'm assuming you've read it.
But, like, those articles, like, I find it hard to really be bothered one way or the other by them because they're just equations. I mean, it's just like this movie greater sign this other movie,
and yeah,
I can see,
and then he gives like a couple sentences of
right, and that's like I scoff at it, but he's so engaged in his own joke that, which is part of writing an article like that, and I get it, I'm guilty of that as well, but you have to apply a little bit of value behind your opinion in order for it to actually get under somebody's skin beyond just being like, because otherwise you just come across as a curmudgeon or a provocateur, and I think that gets boring really quickly.
Well, I don't doubt for a second that Armin White doesn't think that there's value behind his writing. I mean, I'm sure. I've not met Armin White. I mean, perhaps you have.
I've been in the same room with him on hundreds of occasions, but I have never in any circumstance gone up to actually speak to him.
Does anyone go up to speak to him?
I'm sure his friends do. He seems like, I see him engaged in conversation. I've overheard some choice bon mots, but there's nothing in it for me at this point.
So kind of tying that in, as a New Yorker, you have the great benefit of, not only the city, but of a city that kind of allows you to see about any film you want in a theater, commercial, art, classic, etc. So how many movies do you watch in a given week? And this obviously can vary.
I often feel like I'm wasting this incredible resource because I live two blocks from something called the Anthology Film Archives, which is like Film Forum on steroids. I mean, the films they show are much more esoteric and aggressively curated, and it's the kind of place that you won't find more or less anywhere else in the world. And so I live, you know, within walking distance, definitely, and I almost never go. And I feel terrible about that. I mean, the thing is that there's an embarrassment of riches here in the city. I say this with this is a sweeping generalization and a dig, but I really can't imagine being a cinephile and living anywhere else in the world. I've been to Austin several times, and of course there's LA and other places around that, but it, for me, and I think for the people who live here, anyone who thinks that you can really engage with cinema culture like this, or at least for us, for like cinephiles who want to watch these movies, anywhere else in the world is fooling themselves. Mm-hmm. And now that we're getting some draft houses of our own, I mean, I think that is even more apparent. But how many movies do I see in a week? I don't know. I mean, all the movies I see these days are in press screenings and between school and work. My repertory schedule is almost entirely confined to 4 a.m. on my computer, which, you know, I run this Criterion column, and so they, for the most part, determine what it is that I'm watching at any given time because I have my my own sort of self-imposed assignments, and I got to do it. But I'm, you know, I'm wasting such an incredible city of film.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think everyone kind of feels like that. But I mean, yeah, I would love to, you know, as much as I think Fresno, California is the apex of cinephile, yeah. I guess to sort of switch gears, it's been said like hundreds of times that, I'll reiterate, the fact that we're in an interesting, quote unquote, interesting time for film criticism. You know, everyone has the possibility to write about movies, and it's kind of exciting, and it's also simultaneously a bit terrifying, at least for me. So, I mean, what do you, what is your take on the current state of affairs, I guess?
I mean, I think, you know, everyone can write about anything, but I don't know. Do I have anything of particular value to add to that conversation? Probably not. I think that people have to, the onus becomes more now than ever on the reader rather than the writer to determine what it is that is contributing to and forming their world of film criticism. And I think that Twitter is a great analog for that because we determine really bluntly who it is that we follow, who it is that we don't. And those people shape our understanding and sort of the discourse around the film world. And so I think it's about being a reader, determining for yourself who constitutes a good critic, a real critic, and somebody worth reading, and who doesn't. And so, you know, there's a lot more responsibility now on the reader than there ever has been, because the responsibility to the writer is so diffuse. I mean, because you can get, you can read about, you know, 8 billion reviews of Safe Haven, but, you know, you have to pick whose review you're going to read, because you're only going to be interested in reading so many.
Yeah, well, I guess kind of going off that, I think that a lot of the people, I don't know how to say this without sounding pompous, but it's like, I sometimes think they're making the wrong choice of people to read. I mean, this basically, what I think, like, that Peter Travers still has a job. Like, that doesn't bother me. Like, good for him that he's working, and I'm happy for him and his family, whatever, but, I always kind of question whether I think people are reading the right. There's no right or wrong, I guess. But
yeah, but I mean, you see, and we don't have to name names necessarily, but you know that there are critics out there who are unworthy of the size of the audience that they have, or have inherited, or have somehow duped people into helping them establish, and it can be baffling. But you just have to do what it is that you do and really sort of embrace your own voice and hope that people will respond to it. But at the same time, I found that it's also about the quality of your audience and not simply their size.
Yeah. Well,
I think, you know, if you attract the right readers and you have the right pockets of respect, you will also do very, very well, even if you have a fraction of the number of followers or page views of someone else.
That is a good point. But was there a moment, or do you kind of remember when, or maybe you, I'm sure you, I think you have, but maybe you will disagree, a time where you kind of found your voice?
I don't know. I that's a good question. I mean, I think it's always sort of evolving, I would hope, but there wasn't really a eureka moment. I don't think. I think there are different areas of it. I mean, I think some of the most rewarding stuff I've done wouldn't even qualify as film criticism. I think of diary pieces that I wrote for Eric Davis's sites about like what the experience of being at South by Southwest was like, which are like very crude journal entry type things, like live blogging a drunken 48-hour orgy of movies and alcoholic milkshakes. And I think that was very integral to me finding my voice as well, even though I wouldn't necessarily submit it to a academic journal of some kind.
How you got into Columbia, as I'm assuming.
I mean, naturally. That and bribes. But I don't know. I don't know if I had a eureka moment, but certainly, you know, there are moments of validation come from when you, going back to the quality over quantity thing, it's not when you post an article and it gets 100 comments, because you could, you know, just, you know, take a shit on something and call, you know, say something provocative and on the internet. I mean, look at BuzzFeed. It's not exactly a badge of honor to have a big audience. But when you see certain people coming out of the Twitter sphere or whatever it is to say nice piece or you know, make their presence known to you, that is validating.
Mm-hmm. Twitter, so you run 3 Twitter accounts.
I do.
So how is that?
It's a fucking nightmare.
That sounds like a nightmare. Saying it sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah, I have the film.com Twitter account that I recently inherited, and I'm really trying to, you know, it's hard. That one is hard. I have my personal account, which is what it is.
That's easier. That's just you being.
Yeah. You have to understand your audience there as well. I mean, it's like, you know, I try to make it somewhat coherent and mostly keep it towards film, because I know that the brunt of my followers are coming at me as film fans and like want to, you know, it's like it's a professional thing, really.
But why is there no capitalization?
Oh,
I noticed that, and I've never met you, so I don't know, is that like something you do? I mean, obviously it's something you do consciously, because you're a smart guy and you capitalize for everything else.
I am aware of capitalization, that it exists, and how one would use it, so lest anyone be doubting that, I can put those rumors to rest, but I don't know. I mean, I think that it just seems to me like the language of Twitter, like a way of sort of divining the formality with the informality, and just mm-hmm. saying like, you know, don't like these tweets are sort of off the cuff, but I don't know. It seemed like the right mode for me. I think, you know, I feel like I sound sort of like Dr. Evil if I'm like, he found capital letters to be presumptuous. You know, I don't know.
When I see that, I think of like that Michael Haneke parody account.
I hate that account, but capitalization first, Mr. Haneke. I loathe sort of that internet web speak short form, like LOL, which the Haneke account I think does a good job of parodying. You will never, I think, you know, most of the people I follow tend to stick away from that sort of thing. But I don't know, it's just like, you know, it's something that I don't even do consciously anymore. I feel like I have to think about using a capital letter. but I also think it creates a nice aesthetic disparity between the fact that my way of presenting film titles is to capitalize the entire title. And so I think having exclusively lowercase letters elsewhere in the tweet just draws your eye to the title of the movie a little bit more directly. Mm-hmm. So if you're just scanning your tweet feed, your Twitter feed, and you see the name of a movie and it intrigues you and you want to read about it, I think your eye just sort of naturally goes there. But I think that suggests that I poured more thought into it than I have. But no, and then I have the Criterion Corner Twitter feed, which is the easiest because the audience there, I don't stress about what I tweet from that feed, because the audience that I've built for that tweet, that feed is, they're happy to see news about anything Criterion related or just sort of errant opinions about pertinent films. I think, you know, I love the people that follow that account because I think that I get them. I understand what they're looking for. And so like I feel like that's a really low stress thing for me to run. The film.com is going to be the hardest nut to crack because I inherited it. And the personal one is just, there comes with all the baggage of a personal account that you want people to like you and you want, you know, you want people to, yeah. So you also have to sort of express who you are a little bit closer. I don't know, but it's not easy. And the, you know, had you told me a few years ago when I, you know, made a snap decision to join Twitter one morning after, I felt like all of my friends were already on it, that it would occupy this part of my life and that I would now be like paid. I mean, like part of my job is to maintain this Twitter feed and to use it as a way of drawing attention to our content. I would have thought you were insane. So
yeah, well, I'm glad you're one of the few people who I think makes a conscious effort to create an aesthetic disparity.
I hope so. I know it always kills me when I have to when I tweet from one account and then retweet the same thing from another, and it was exclusively in the interest of drawing the people that know me personally and like you know, and me in the life towards my new work account. But I always feel like it's hideous, but I have to do it.
Yeah,
for
I do it as well for my account and then the mezzanine account.
Yeah,
and I kind of feel bad. I don't know. Yeah, it's interesting how much Twitter is kind of, it's both sad. I love Twitter. I don't know how to kind of get into this, but I feel it does kind of consume too much of my time at points.
Yeah, I mean, it's for sure, and I think I really value it as this sort of constant, massive conversation that's happening between all. And, without Twitter, I probably wouldn't be doing these jobs. I don't think that I would have been able to establish a presence for myself. And I also wouldn't have met been put into contact with people like yourself or any of the hundreds of other people that I've been fortunate enough to cross paths with who live in Utah and California and Toronto and Asia and, wherever, that I feel like we're all involved in one constant conversation. And I think that's really, really remarkable. And so Twitter has its drawbacks, and I do think that an inordinate amount of my energy is wasted on it. But at the same time, I think that it is this incredible force that when people slag overall the way that people say, like, oh, I don't watch TV, I think they are turning a blind eye to this incredible social mechanism.
No, definitely. And I think especially it's even more beneficial when you're using it for professional reasons. They did that in the Twitter archive thing, and I looked back and, I tweeted to you how like terrible I thought it was.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, you're still terrible.
I immediately downloaded mine. It was so much worse than I ever could have imagined.
No, it could have not been worse than mine. Like, mine is like the worst piece of shit ever. And I I went into a coma for 10 days afterwards. But besides that,
yikes,
a terrible joke.
Glad you woke up. No.
You guys were having that discussion on Opkino about. It actually was kind of happening on Critic Wire, and I think it was initially provoked by Dana Stevens at the Lincoln Center or something.
Yeah, it was Dana Stevens and. That Will Leitch, liberally.
Yeah. Deadspin, I think, or something.
Yeah.
And that was just about kind of, I'm trying to remember. It's about how useful Twitter can be and whether it's good to tweet about movies right after a film. And I don't remember what was.
My stance was sort of incoherent on Opkino, at least. But
and sensation.
I mean, it generally boiled down to the fact that both. As someone who comes from a film theory background, I think any of these conversations go back to, the how film works as a medium fundamentally, and I won't get lost in that whole conversation again, but essentially just talking about how, film is inherently, this is film theory 101, is inherently an illusion that sort of, a confluence of light and other sorts of stimuli that the human brain sort of coheres into perception. I think Twitter works much the same way in that, like, as far as tweeting after a movie, I mean, you have that sort of the response to the stimuli or whatever, rudimentary thoughts you've been able to assemble in your brain, and then you have a more considered opinion that you save maybe for your review or Twitter conversation down the line. But I really think that it is fundamentally incorrect to suggest that only one of those can be valid that one has more weight than the other. Again, I think as people stressed in that Critic Wire survey, there are ways of doing this correctly and ways of doing this incorrectly. There is no value to seeing a movie and saying, like, oh, it was awesome or whatever. That's a poor way of saying it. But there are people who can come out of a movie and tweet something of that doesn't try to move away from the fact that they just saw this, but at the same time has a little bit of value to it that might not have the half-life that survives for their longer review. And then there are people that can't do it very well. And I think, again, the onus is on the reader to determine who those people are and to follow them. But I don't think it's inherently wrong by any stretch of the imagination.
No, I don't either. I think it's something I try not to do it after press screenings. I mean, usually because of stuff, the press screenings we get here in Fresno are movies I don't like very much, and I don't really want to... I mean, I could save it for the review, but it was interesting to see how that sort of plays out at a festival. Because I went to TIFF in September, and it was definitely present there, but I guess at Sundance I was with a lot of the people I followed. And so just kind of seeing the just plethora of responses after a movie that I was just in, and they were just making all these declarative statements, and it did feel kind of like, as mentioned, that four-square check-in, like, hey, I saw this movie, you can't see it, so fuck you, and look at me. And it did feel like that quite often, and you're talking about stuff of value, and I kind of thought a lot of it didn't have any value. And there's actually something I didn't do, and I did it a little bit, I think, for Before Midnight, only because that movie is perhaps my will probably be my favorite movie of the past four or five years.
I'm still at, like, I can't even tell you. I had last night my fourth dream about seeing that movie. I haven't seen the film. But for whatever reason, I keep having Inception-like dreams about seeing the movie in my dream, and then also in like a higher level of dream state, being aware that I was dreaming about seeing the movie, and then waking up and just hating the fact that I haven't. Anyway, go on.
David, it's okay. You will you'll get through it. And,
I won't be able to go to South By, and it's the only movie there that I'm really itching to see.
You're not going to South By?
No, I can't for work. I mean, I've already seen a few of the films that are playing there that makes it a little better. But South By for me is really about seeing people and seeing Before Midnight. And unfortunately, I won't get to do either there. But sorry, you were saying about Twitter and Sundance.
Oh, no, I mean, there's not much to add. I just think a lot of the conversation at festivals are kind of these declarative, let's give a grade and show you what I've seen. And I understand it for work. It does attract an audience, realistically. People want to know what's happening at Sundance, and I understand that. I guess my take on it is, why tweet when I can write like a 400, 500 word post on it? And though I'm sure people are more inclined to read 140 characters more than 140 words, I just kind of find, I found a lot of it not very useful.
Yeah, I mean, maybe one of the reasons that I gravitate towards, I really embrace the idea of this quick Twitter snapshot comment after a film, is that I struggle with the 400 to 500 word thing. I mean, for me, it's this wild binary where it's like I either want to write 140 characters or 140 pages. You know, it's like if the reviews that I really take pleasure in writing, I don't do very frequently at all. But something like Reverse Shot, which is more of a journal than it is a traditional website, and I get to write 2,500 words about new movies, and like that is. That I find a lot of, personally, as a writer, mm-hmm. I get a lot more into that, and I struggle with trying to say anything of meaning but still convey the fundamental ideas and premise of a movie in 400 to 500 words, and that's just my own thing. So I really, really enjoy the Twitter response. And I also, you know, I think that the idea that you're going to be saying the same thing in a tweet, you know, I think people discredit their own gifts as writers if they say that they're wasting their best comments in a tweet, because if you can't unpack that to better suit or to be better articulated in a review, then you're in the wrong line of work. And the people that I've heard say that are people that, for the most part, shouldn't be saying that about their own work. I mean, like someone like Dana Stevens says that. Dana Stevens is an excellent writer, and she can very handily unpack, you know, a sort of snarky one-liner into a paragraph that's worth reading. And so I regret the fact that she doesn't have, you know, that she has to put down the form when she clearly has the gifts to you know, deny her own approach on it. But it is what it is.
No, yeah, she is incredibly talented. So, I think, you know, we can veer away from the Twitter discussion. I mean, it can go on forever. I do find it useful for the most part. And when you mentioned South By and you're talking about seeing people, that is sort of, I'm learning as I'm going to these, that is like the purpose for me to go. Like I'm looking forward to the movies, I'm looking forward to writing, or as much as I could look forward to writing, because festivals prove to be a lot more work than you anticipate.
Oh yeah.
Even when you prepare for it too, it's like,
Well, there's no way to prepare. I mean, you can't write the review before you see
the
movie.
No, I know, but you make a schedule and you, like... Yeah, it's ridiculous. But anyway, yeah, it has kind of become about seeing people and perhaps I'm already nostalgic for last month. But it is kind of, I hate the idea that we're like, we become friends for like 10 days and we talk and we become like close. And then all of a sudden we have to go our separate ways. And for most people it's okay because you're going back to New York and, there is a presence of cinema there, and many of the people are still there.
It's like almost famous for you. It sounds like you go on these tours, and then you go home, and it's like the world carries on without you. But you know, unlike in the 70s, you know, yeah, I can walk down the street and see Mad Patches or whatever. But
aren't you lucky?
But the truth of the matter is that even between all the people who live in the same city, the conversation is still, for the most part, on Twitter. You can't talk in the dark of the movie theaters where even if you happen to be occupying the same screening room to see a movie. So I think the fact that if you go home to Fresno and you fire up Twitter, you're probably just as involved in that world as the rest of us are.
I know, but I like to keep my, you know... antiquated and archaic thinking, and,
right?
Yeah, and the almost famous reference. I think I've heard that 100 billion times by now.
Yeah.
But yeah. So, I guess a couple things to end this. Not that I want to end, and not that I, you know, you're boring to talk to, but first, do you see yourself doing something else? And we talked about filmmaking, like in 5, 10, 15 years, or I mean. Is that something you see realistically? I don't know. Can you envision a time where you can balance doing both?
No, because I think that if you are I make like 2 short films a year, and I make them at at the university's behest, and so it's not like you just get together with your friends in the backyard. They're like long, drawn out processes filled with hours and hours of meeting and lots of regulations and insurances. And I mean, life is sort of put on hold when you do these things. And I think that if I were to make more than, you know, 1 or 2 short films a year, if I were to become a professional filmmaker rather than sort of a student filmmaker, then it would really be impossible to maintain actively another side of life. I mean, certainly, if and when I started making feature films, if my life takes me to that place or whatever, I certainly couldn't be the editor of a website or write for someplace routinely. So there's a little bit of give and take. And, you know, I love movies. I can't imagine, you know, I would always be wanting to be sort of on the vanguard of what was happening in the movie world. And as far as writing about and covering it, I can't imagine not wanting to be engaged in that conversation. And so it would hurt to step back from that, but it can really burn you out. I think for the most part, you find some critics, especially previous generations, who kept up on the beat for 30 years and maybe wrote a book in that time. But at the pace at which film criticism moves these days, and which websites are bought and sold and rebranded, and I mean, it's really rare to see someone be able to truck through it all. Most of us are younger. So, of course, not 30 years, but to see people, you know, move forward for 5 years or 6 years. So, you know, I think in my head, ideally, my future is in filmmaking. Not that, you know, and it's ridiculous that I'm saying of all walks of life, like, oh, filmmaking is where I'm putting my stability right now. Because that's not exactly, an accurate representation of where that whole medium is right now. But I'd like to, it's like my life right now is like 80-20 film coverage versus filmmaking, and if I could reverse that or make it a 90-10 the other way in the next 10 years, I think that'd be great.
I mean, that sounds great. I think anyone who reads your writing would be fascinated into seeing what you could do. And
although, you know, at the same time, sorry to interrupt, but at the same time, I do and this is very hypocritical of me, of course, but I resent this idea that like all film critics are failed or aspiring filmmakers, as if one is categorically superior to the other. and that those who can't make teach or write about. I think, you know, you in film's very brief lifespan, if you look back at Andre Bazin, who you may have tinkered with filmmaking, but I mean, like, the some of the most profound thinkers who really shaped this medium only had an interest in doing that and doing it with a typewriter or a pen and paper. And I think, you know, the way that celebrity works and the way that pay works in our world, it's a pipe dream to think that that side of things will ever get the respect that they deserve. And I, of course, came at it from a filmmaking love first and sort of found my way into film criticism rather than the other way around. I don't know if that excuses me. Probably not. But I think I would love to see people who are more content doing this, because especially if you're doing it at a professional level, there aren't – it's a tough life. You don't make too much money, but there aren't, if you love it, that many things in the world that are better than being paid to watch and write about movies.
So, I think that notion's been dispelled for the most part. I mean, I do remember a time – I'm sure it's still present, but – people always saying that, oh, you're writing about movies, oh, so you couldn't make it as a filmmaker. So, and I always, it didn't apply to me, naturally. I'm still in high school, so. But I always thought that was just such a ridiculous theory. Yeah. As if, like, reporters of, like, basketball games were failed basketball players, though a lot of them, I guess that's not a great analogy, because a lot of them were retired. That's a long story.
Right, and it would be if they were 6.5 feet tall. But
Well, I mean, I don't know how much you watch sports, but I mean, if the market now is, hey, let's try to find a moderately articulate ex-basketball player to... Even if it is Shaq.
Yeah,
or...
I'm a hockey addict, and that's true. It's as true in the hockey world as in the basketball world. And again, that's the influence of celebrities, because they don't need to be, you know, the presentation is ostensibly less important than the image of it, you know, than the
idea.
I mean,
the presentation is them. They exist, and they used to play, and hey, do you remember when we were great? And so who cares if I have anything really... and add to the conversation.
Exactly.
But yeah, that's not sports. I'm not sure is what.
And now you have Kareem Abdul-Jabbar reviewing Girls.
Yes,
which is like the ultimate. And his review was hilarious. I mean, I thought, you know, he could have made it as a writer. So maybe it's a poor example. But at the same time, the way that the celebrity sort of steamrolls every other domain and immediately prioritizes that voice can be troubling.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. That was. I actually linked that in our. Kind of roundup post we do every Monday, and because I found it enjoyable, but I was contemplating, like, did he just like want to write something and was like, oh yeah, okay, I'm just gonna do that, and a big publication is going to publish it, and that's that, because I'm Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, which I understand, it makes sense. He has a lot of weight, and he's a smart guy. So so I guess lastly, aside from the paychecks that come in, or for most of us, the lack of paychecks. As a writer, what keeps you motivated to do what you're doing?
You know, my answers to that are just impossibly generic, but it's just, you know, I mean, I think a lot of it is better exploring myself and the things that make me tick. You know, seeing all these movies and just judging, giving them a star rating on Letterboxd and moving along with my life wouldn't really be of any value to me. And sometimes I raise an eyebrow when people watch 500 movies a year, and I'm like, how much time are you really giving to letting these movies sort of grow with you? But I think in forcing myself, or in the nature of my job, being forced to think deeper and engage on Twitter or whatever it is with these movies, you know, it ultimately allows me to grow and connect with new people. And of course, in the movie world, the excitement is always there, because you're always excited about new movies. I mean, it never stops. You get like, there's like a 2-week period at the end of December where you've seen all the movies for the year and you can sort of catch your breath. But as soon as January rolls around, there's Sundance, and immediately you're anticipating things again. And I think it would be really hard for me to go through life without being constantly anticipating things. I mean, that's it's always be, you know, and I hate that culture, this sort of anticipatory film writing culture, and I I never write about casting rumors or film news for the most part, but in my own head, just to be excited for what I'm about to see next, that would, you know, keeps me going all the time. I'm having those before midnight dreams, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
You know? I think you're one of the few people who's having before midnight dreams.
It's never happened to me with any other movie. I don't know what it is, you know, maybe just living, you know, having these films have been a part of my life for so long, and having I love that I know the characters so well and can imagine what their conversations would be like, but at the same time, know absolutely nothing about the structure of the film, sort of like where they are in their lives, how they meet, you know, beyond the fact that it takes place in Greece. And so I think those two polarities are sort of fighting in my own, you know, sleeping brain to make something that makes sense. Anyway.
I really do hope, God, I hope you enjoy it. Otherwise, it'll just be such a... You'll be so depressed for...
I'm not too worried about, you know, whether I enjoy it more than Before Sunset. That's up for debate. But I'm not too worried about not liking the film based on the responses so far. I just hope that as South By goes along and more people see it, that I can remain... and I'm not a spoiler phobe by any stretch of the imagination. This is really the one example, the one anomaly where I really hope that I can just remain pure for it, because I know nothing about it, and that's how I like it. Yeah.
I imagine it will. I just remember the screening, and we'll end after this, but I just remember the screening, and we were all anticipating it. I went to the P&I one at Sundance, and last minute, Elvis Mitchell walks in, and behind him, or talking to him, is Harvey Weinstein.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, I've not met Harvey Weinstein. I've never seen him. I know only of him.
Mm-hmm.
Someone informed me after the movie that after 10 minutes, he left.
Right.
Which, to me, is a good indicator that it's a good movie. So
yeah, probably. And he probably, I mean, hey, who knows? He may have immediately wanted to get on the phone and start negotiating for
it. The movie was already bought. So,
oh, it was?
Yeah, that's why we were all kind of shocked that he was here, because God knows enjoying cinema is not something he does. So...
I don't know. That's a whole different
conversation.
I was reading an oral history about Pulp Fiction this week, and he has a brusque manner about him. But I think, as ruthless of a businessman and a wheeler and dealer as he is, it's really hard to read about him and his pivotal moments without understanding that there's like an underlying love for a certain stripe of cinema underneath all of that. So who knows? But yeah, I think I have heard that story about the Before Midnight screening, and maybe it can be one of those mysteries as to why he left that exists throughout the rest of cinema history.
I'm sure people will not be contemplating why Harvey Weinstein left the screening 20 years down the road, but hey,
probably
you know
not.
I think you'll like the movie. So why don't you tell everyone where they can find your work?
Yeah, if you made it this far in the interview, thanks for listening. Yeah, you can find me at, first and foremost, at film.com, which is a pretty easy URL to remember, and at filmdotcom on Twitter, which is a website that I'm really, really excited about the future for, and really hoping to give a new voice and move forward to become a really exciting destination to visit, if it isn't already. And you can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich and at Criterion Corner. And Operation Kino, our podcast, some weeks more coherent than others, but my co-hosts are wonderful, and that's through Cinema Blend, and on iTunes we release two episodes a week, and I think that's enough of me on the internet for now.
No, definitely listen to Op Kino. I just started too, and the two episodes a week, that's a good move, though. You're not typically on the review one, or occasionally you are? Or?
No, I will be when I see the movies.
Oh, okay.
I just, this week, it was like, you know, you can go take your girlfriend for dinner for her birthday, or you can see Die Hard 5.
Go with the girlfriend. Yep.
I'm out.
Priorities.
So when I've seen the movie, you know, either way, I'll be on there when I'm available to, even if I haven't seen the movie, just to snipe at my fellow critics from the Peanut Gallery. But
it's always fun.
Right, but you can find me on both for the most part.
Good people. You can find me, Sam Fragoso, at my Twitter account, which is exactly my name, SamFragoso, which people tend to spell incorrectly very often, which is okay. And you can find everything I write, or most of it, at my site, Movie Mezzanine, spelled out M-E-Z-Z-A-N-I-N-E if you can't spell mezzanine. Hopefully you can. And I'm trying to think. Some work appears on the film stage, Fan the Fire magazine, and all of the other stuff. I think that's also enough of me. Thank you for listening, and hope you enjoy it. Bye-bye. Cause I'm a